Open wide for some soccer!
The San Jose Earthquakes present The Soccer Hour on KNBR 1050.
Brought to you exclusively by your NorCal Honda dealers.
Now here's your host, Ted Rainey.
All right, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Soccer Hour on KMBR 1050, brought to you by your NorCal Honda dealers. We've got World Cup talk to get into right off the bat, and then we are going to be joined by Amanda Vandervoort, the president of the USL Super League. But first, we are going to be joined by Ryan O'Hanlon of ESPN. Ryan, what's going on, man? I will give the full spectrum of the day we're looking at. This is Wednesday morning we're recording this. This is going to air Wednesday evening. For the first time in 17 days, there is not a World Cup game on. And, you know, the riff that we've been having here before we started is like, what did we do with our lives before we were just inundated by soccer from literally the minute we woke up until like well into the afternoon?
Yeah, I'm in the West Coast as well. So my morning was getting out of bed, my brain being like, what is my take? Like getting ready for like to have form a take in my head about a soccer game. Then being like, no, you could actually just like stay in bed for a little bit. But then getting out of bed and being like, so what do I do? Like, it's 7:15. What did I do for like the 2 hours before nine, like prepping for my days in the past? I have no idea. So came on here to work
talk
through
about
that.
Soccer. Yeah. I'm glad to be, adding a little bit more structure to your day. But, I will start with the big question, rating the United States men's national team after four games, a sound defeating at the hands of the Netherlands, who looked really, really good. And there's a couple things I want to talk about that game, but just, your reaction to everything that you saw from the U.S.
Yeah, I think we kind of talked about this last time I was on, but I think to me, it's like an unadulterated success, the World Cup. The U.S. had the youngest, by the time they were knocked out, they had the youngest team based on average age weighted for the number of minutes played. And so you take that into account, throw in the fact that they deservedly got out of their group, didn't lose a game in the group stages. And then, they lost to a better team in the round of 16. But I don't know, to me, I thought the game was a lot closer than the scoreline suggested. I think, so if you look at expected goals for the game, it was basically even between the two teams, which maybe, undersells the fact that the Netherlands scored right away and maybe wasn't attacking as much. But like the U.S. had the best chance of the game by far, Pulisic's chance right at the beginning. And I do think that like when you give up two very similar looking goals on like perfectly precise counterattacks, it's easy to look at those things and be like, of course that happened. Like, of course they were going to end that with a goal. But like the number of times the Netherlands creates those two counters and scores both times on them, I would say is in like the 15 to 20% range. Especially Daley Blind, their left wing back, who hadn't scored a goal in 8 years, finishing the one time chance from 15 yards out with his right foot. Like when that happens, it's kind of just not your day. So it's funny. Like I texted my family, 12 minutes into the game, and I was like, the U.S. just might be the better team here. And then the Dutch counterattack and score. And it's like, maybe not. But I thought it was like a closer game than the scoreline suggested. And they were very much in reach of like a bounce or two goes your way and you win that game, I think. So all of that into account with the fact that it's the youngest team in the tournament, I don't know how you can't look at that as a pretty big success.
Why was the Netherlands the one team that was able to get a counterattack going against the U.S.? Because we didn't see that at all versus Wales, England, Iran. Like, they couldn't do that. And I know that the Netherlands did it successfully a couple of times, but they had other opportunities as well. And that was something that was interesting. I was like, whoa, no other team has been able to do this. Some people have said that they were able to bait the U.S. a little bit. That was some impressive coaching. I think Berhalter was outcoached, but not to the extent that some people are making it. I think people are being way too hyperbolic. And I'm like, I don't know, guys. Like,
it's wild.
Like you said, it was tight. Like, it wasn't that big, but they were able to do that, whereas three other teams were not.
I think the main, like, that's just, if you watch the Netherlands play in 2014, they played a similar way. Mm-hmm. They were just better because they had Van Persie and Robin as their attackers instead mm-hmm. of Memphis and Cody Gakpo. So I think like that, they're kind of, that's like the Louis van Gaal like trademark, like slow passing. And then suddenly you combine like on for six perfectly weighted passes and shoot up the field. Yeah. So I think like they're just kind of like, that was kind of their game plan. And they perfectly executed on it. While I don't think England wasn't as willing to, like, the possession in the US-England game was relatively even, I think, probably more toward England, but England was more willing to just kind of pass it sideways. Like, they're all of their, you know, most frequent pass combinations were like fullback to center back, center back to center back, center back to fullback. The Dutch really weren't, you didn't see that pattern in this game, I feel like, with the US just like, not pressing super high, but, you know, establishing pressure right around midfield and like just not letting them come forward. So I think it's one, the Dutch are just, their coach and the has just a history of coaching up that style. And then they were kind of more willing to cede possession than I think England were, which then did create some space for them to attack into. And I think people think it was a good tactical performance because they executed perfectly twice. But like, I don't know, to me, knowing how much soccer is a percentage game, I don't think that they like created a ton of those opportunities.
What do you think of, I can't remember which goal it was, but it was, yeah, the guy on the back post literally standing there completely unguarded with his hand in the air waving. And like, if you were like me watching TV, it was like, oh my God, like, you know, like it was wide open. Anybody could see it, and the US was all just kind of watching the ball. I mean,
yeah.
How much is that just an isolated incidents, or is it something that needs to be taken out of their DNA or coached out, or like where do you fall on that?
Yeah, so first I want to point out that now I'm realizing that then that chance was finished off by their right wing back Denzel Dumfries with his left foot on a one-time volley. So two of the goals are scored by the wing backs with their off foot. So when that happens, it's truly just not your day. But in that moment, to me, so like we had the first goal where Tyler Adams and Musa kind of like, Tyler Adams doesn't seem to track back as hard as he normally does. And Musa kind of is just at sea in a way and doesn't. I think you want to drop back right to the penalty area, basically, because that's where they want to create the cutback to. You see it happen so much. Yeah. And Musa kind of just followed, got pulled out of that position. And then Dest kind of fell asleep for a second against Daley Blind. But I think with Dest, that's just like, he was incredible, I thought, that game. Otherwise, like, he's not the best player in the world, so you are going to like have a brain fart defensively per game. But with that goal, to me, it was honestly more like, I feel like minutes prior, Anthony Robinson looked like both of his hamstrings like had disintegrated into sawdust and he was just laying on the ground. And it was like that game, it was very clear to me that like the guys in the team were mostly just dead. Yeah. Like, I think Pulisic was the most impressive guy in that game, and he got a rest for 45 minutes because of his pelvic injury. So he was a little fresher. So to me, I think that specific moment, I attributed that more to Anthony Robinson just being so freaking exhausted that his brain just shut off for a second. Cause he's not really the type of player, especially cause him and Tim Ream play together with their club team. They're used to like handling the rotations on the back post. I think to me that seemed like a clear, just like he was so tired and it affected, you know, his ability to like process what was happening in front of him for a minute.
I mean, that leads to one of the greater discussions about trying to bring in more depth to the team. And, you know, I will get to the Reina question in a second, but in terms of that depth, if we had guessed the team in 2018 versus what it was in 2022, we would have been way off. We can try and start guessing now for 2026, and you know, I'm good at being wrong. But I mean, is depth the big issue? Is that where you're saying like, hey, this has got to be rectified if they want to get beyond where they did this year?
Yeah, that's like my ultimate takeaway from the tournament. Like, to simplify it, it's like, the US has 9 good players and they need 15. And good is like a very relative term. Good in terms of like guys that can contribute consistent minutes to a deep World Cup run. So I look at it this way, right? I think when you're cycling center backs between games, it suggests that like that's the center, one of the center back spots is like not up to snuff, right? I think that's a reasonable thing. Otherwise you keep the center backs. So then you have that, and then we have the striker position. So that's, everyone agrees that it, the production you're getting from that role is not up to the level, right? But everyone else, I think, is a good enough contributor to like a team that could make the semifinals at the World Cup. So you have those nine guys. Brendan Aaronson, you think he's kind of that caliber, right? But I didn't really think he performed that way at the World Cup. Didn't really, there's just, it's so hard to get it out of my head. He had Daley Blind like 1v1 on the sideline, and it's like Daley Blind's this old, you know, haggard guy who's not a good defender, and Aaronson's this young guy who's barely played, and Daley Blind just completely stones him and wins the ball back. And then you have the Reyna situation, which we've kind of been baffled by, me and you talking, but then I don't really think Reyna did all that much when he came in, given how fresh he would be compared to everyone else. So I think in some ways their performances suggested to me that like Berhalter saw them play in training and had some ideas in his head. So you take all this, you have kind of nine quality contributors, right? That degrades over the course of the tournament. The US was never really able to rest anyone because their last game mattered so much. McKinney and Des could only go about 65 minutes each a game. And unfortunately, the backup to Serginho Dest is just, it's a massive drop off in quality, right? It's just Shaq Moore and Yedlin are like good MLS players, but compared to Serginho Dest, it's just not the same level. No. And then in the midfield, you have the three guys, right? That's like the core heart of the team, but the fourth guy is just not at that level either. And then I think you could say the same thing about the attack, right? Pulisic and Weah, there was a drop off if you took Weah off, which there shouldn't be. So I think like by you get to the Netherlands game and it's like they're rested while the US has like nine players they have to rely on, and they're not performing at the level they were performing at in say game two because they're super tired. So to me, it's like you need another fullback, you probably need another midfielder, then you need two more attackers that can, you know, maintain the level when you sub them in the 60th minute. That's like the large takeaway for me.
I mean, I thought that with Ferreira, well, Berhalter was thinking that he could do a lot of the same things that Sargent can do. And I think that in essence, or in, I'll put it in theory, he can, but he was not able to do that. And I think that's why people were so upset that he didn't instead start Reyna. Like the thought was it was going to be like a like for like, but it didn't play out that way.
Yeah. I mean, it was a tough situation for Ferreira, especially because like, you know, these guys that are playing in Europe, they're playing higher quality soccer games than the World Cup, like on a consistent basis. But for Ferreira, that would be the highest quality soccer game he's probably ever played in.
In the biggest game of his life.
Yeah, and he hasn't played in the group stages. And I thought like he was like, he played in a way that like was designed to have people get mad at him. Like he kept losing the ball, but I think he was losing the ball because he was at least like getting into spaces, right, to get on the ball. It just, the touches just didn't come off. So I don't think he was as terrible as everyone thought. I'd rather have a guy just like showing for the ball and losing it than just like being completely absent for 45 minutes, which happens a lot of the times with the U.S. striker.
I agree. And then, you know, looking at, in terms of, this is what I've seen. And like, again, I want to point out, this is not my opinion. These are just things that I see consistently said. People are like, one cycle, one coach, move on. Well, what do you think about that take? That's I have issues with Berhalter. I also like a lot of the things that he does. So where do you fall in this? Like, I am not an advocate of like, let's move on. I'm just kind of an advocate of like, let's try and quantify and qualify what we saw. And again, I can't point out a failure. I would have liked them to have gone deeper, but I don't think that there was something like there was some string that Berhalter didn't pull that another coach would have. I think like you alluded to, like he saw things in training. He had a really good idea. He knows what it takes and put the best guys out there that he could. Like there's this thing in all sports where it's like that third stringer, that's the guy who's going to fix everything. And it's like, is it like really like you just think like because like people get enamored with potential as opposed to reality.
Yeah. The most promising player in the US pool is whatever guy that coach doesn't call up. Yeah. Right. like Brandon Vasquez. Imagine what we what. Maybe he could be great for the U.S., but like it's so easy to point to all the guys that you didn't see not do it. And yeah, I agree. Like, especially given what I was saying about Reyna and Aronson, I don't really know what else Berhalter could have done, because like obviously subbing is a very important lever that most managers don't pull aggressively enough. Mm-hmm. But that's like when it's at the club level, and most teams have roughly the similar, most teams have similar levels of depth regardless of their financial standing, right? Like the 15th guy on Liverpool is usually just as good compared to a starter as like the 15th guy on Brighton or whatever, just because all the players are worse or whatever. But with the US, I think you can make a reasonable argument that like a incredibly tired Weston McKennie is better than whoever the midfielder they had that could have came in for him at full strength. But so I don't really, I guess this whole one cycle thing is just based on past experience, right? Because like the Bob Bradley era kind of ended poorly with the loss to Mexico. And then obviously Klinsmann gets fired midway through. But I think Klinsmann, there were warning signs during the entire era rather than just because he lasted for so long. But like you look at the last two teams that won the World Cup, those were second cycle managers. Yeah. You look at, we're at the quarterfinals now. So, Brazil, Croatia, those are two guys that are on their second World Cup cycles. Southgate's on his second. I don't know if invoking Southgate's going to make people feel too good about the U.S. Deschamps is on his third World Cup cycle. Fernando Santos has been with Portugal for, this is his second World Cup cycle, I believe. So at least half the teams. But then on the other side, Morocco fired their coach after they lost to the U.S. over the summer. And now everyone's like, this team is coached amazingly. So yeah, I think this like hard and fast, you can't do more than one cycle. I actually don't understand, like, that's not based in any empirical evidence as far as I'm aware.
It's interesting because you look at the way that coaches in all sports, and it seems like if there's anything you can consistently point to, it is consistency in and of itself. Like there is a, and again, we could debate this for hours, but I feel like there is a correlation between consistency of a head coach and then the output. And like, I know people could say, of course they don't fire the guy that's winning. And I'm like, okay, I get that. But like there are other factors to take into account, obviously. In terms of some of the results we've seen, like a Morocco advancing past Spain, and you know, there've been a couple others. We talked about it a couple weeks ago, like how it's harder to be better than it ever was. Is that from the massive amounts of information out there and that coaches are allowed to prepare with and, you know, use their tactics to build towards? Or is the depth of talent for the player pool, is it that much more level to where any given game day you can watch something relatively unexpected happen? Like, I didn't expect Morocco to beat Spain, nor did I expect it to play to a 0-0 draw and be won on penalties. Like, that's just not, you know, what I don't think anyone expected out of that game yesterday, yet that's where we are.
Yeah, I think it's probably both. The first part's definitely true, and I think there's probably like hundreds of people out there that could like do a good job coaching the U.S. who we've never heard of, right? But I think the latter point, I don't know, with all this stuff, I think talent is always what you kind of have to fall back on. That's the most, the biggest decider of what happens on the field, as much as we like to blame the coaches for things, because it's much easier to relate to a coach than it is to like Richarlison or something like that. But yeah, so I don't know, like you look at Morocco and it's like most of their team is playing in Europe. And then they have a handful of stars like Hakimi and Ziyech who play for PSG and Chelsea. So I think it's probably that the talent has risen everywhere, partially because it's not even like, it's not like there's more soccer teams. I guess like with the advent of MLS, MLS has improved. And with big money soccer, right? The money in European soccer growing, it's incentivizing like clubs across the world to like develop talent so they can sell them and make like $5 million or whatever. So there's that. But I also think it's like the leagues themselves are scouting in a much more diverse talent base than they were 25 years ago, 30 years ago. So you have American players who are probably getting a little bit more of a look than they would have gotten in the past. You have Moroccan players are getting a little bit more of a look. And then you also have an increasing like national teams are much more open to players that are not born in their country, basically. Yeah. So they're also upping their, Morocco's a prime example of that. Ziyech could have played for the Netherlands, but played for Morocco. Hakimi was born in Spain. So you have kind of all these little global economic factors that are like raising the talent level at these teams that even if they, you know, Morocco played the sort of classic defend and counter style, right? Mm-hmm. Like we've seen that in the, for 80 years in soccer history, that's what you do. But since they have all these good players, they were way more effective when they were defending. Spain didn't create anything. And then the few times they did counter, they created really good opportunities because you have like Hakim Ziyech playing the through ball rather than like the random dude that plays in the Moroccan league you would have had 32 years ago or whatever.
Well, this is where I start thinking about 2026 and expansion. And then I compare it to, and this is not an apples to apples comparison, but like, I think like each year in college basketball, you see 68 teams and sometimes things play very much as you would expect them. And then other times they don't at all. Like that's why so much of what I'm wondering is like, should we expect more inherent craziness in 2026? Or should we expect that maybe the deficiencies between the top and lower tier programs would be even that much more obvious? Like it's not very often in March Madness that a play-in team does something particularly special. Every once in a while, you'll get a great upset. Like it seems to end where it should. But then at the same time, I'm like, well, what is that really indicative of? And how does that compare and contrast to world and global soccer when we're talking about expanding the field even more? But at the same time, it does have that feel like, well, yeah, anything can happen.
Yeah, I mean, after the Spain-Costa Rica game, I was definitely in my head like, oh, God, Germany is going to play like El Salvador in Orlando or whatever, and it's going to be like 15-0. Do we really need that? But then we saw that the group stages were pretty fun, right? Like Costa Rica won a game. They were beating Germany at one point. Obviously, Germany didn't even get out of the group. I think more rather than the expanded like field, you're going to get Brazil against like the 40th best team instead of the 32nd best team, and that's going to go poorly, I would imagine. But I think the structure of it is going to create even more randomness. They still haven't announced how they're going to do the groups. Yeah. Initially, it was going to be three team groups, so you play two games and anything can happen in two games, right? Spain won their first game 7-0. Then they didn't win their next two games. So like if those were the two games they had in the three game group stages, they would have been out of the tournament like right away.
Yeah.
And then it's going to be a 32 team knockout round. And I think just more single game elimination introduces even more variance. So basically what I'm saying is the U.S. it's going to have its best chance of winning the World Cup in 2026.
Is that good though? I mean, does having just that, inherent craziness, is that good for the sport or does it disenfranchise any fans? I mean, it's weird because like college sports, and again, this is not an apples to apples comparison, but I always like talk about like why you have these fans of the SEC and it's like, well, these programs are old. Like you have generations of people that have been rooting for Alabama and like that, like it makes a difference as opposed to like MLS where you have like maybe two generations that have been rooting for the Galaxy, like on a good day. Mm-hmm. And then I say like, well, what happens when you upset the balance to world football fans? And they say like, we have a generational team and because chaos was applied, our great chance didn't happen. Like does that potentially build resentment amongst fans? Or does FIFA have such power that it really doesn't matter because those fans that were disenfranchised would be replaced?
Yeah, I don't think most fans would understand the randomness of the World Cup, basically, is how I would look at it. They wouldn't look at it as if this new structure screwed us. They would look at it as our coach is terrible and we need a new coach. like Germany, to me, they just like, I think Germany could have won the World Cup if they got out of their group. Like they played an incredibly high variant style, but like they completely dominated the game against Japan and just like the bounces didn't go their way. And then Spain happened to lose to Japan, right? So that's why they were eliminated. And I think a ton of German fans want Hansi Flick fired. They just announced today that they're bringing him back. And that's because Germany's one of the better run federations. So they understand it. So I don't think it's going to like drive away fans, because I don't think fans are aware that like right now, the World Cup isn't designed to find the best team in the world, right? It's designed to find like one of the like seven or eight best teams, yeah. basically, with the way it's structured. You're only playing max seven games. So it's not, and that's what makes it great, because it only happens once every 4 years. I think it's more of a question of like, so the group stages were, at least the third game of the group stages were incredible. This one, like every day, something crazy seemed to be happening. But then, you know, you look at the quarterfinals and it's like, of the teams that were, you know, ranked as like the top eight going into it, it's, I would say six of them are there still.
Yeah.
So, and that seems to be what happens with March Madness, right? It's like, there's a ton of upsets, but then like you get to the final four and it's like,
it's who you expected.
It roughly who you expected, minus like one team that got upset, right? Yeah. So I think like, I don't know, if it consistently doesn't have the best teams playing against each other, maybe that changes the way people feel about the World Cup, but also maybe not. Maybe, you know, it is the World Cup, and we'll, you know, we're coming at it from like an American-centric, but also then kind of like a Euro-centric viewpoint, yeah. I feel like. So everyone else probably doesn't really care if, you know, Morocco's upsetting Spain, and but also all the other big teams are getting upset and it's a bunch of random teams. And, you know, frankly, that might be nice to see, even if like the quality of the later games aren't as good.
Last one for you. Who's the best team left?
I think it's Brazil. Really going out on a limb there.
They are fun to watch. Like, they're like, to me, when you're watching that type of playfulness happen at such a high level, like, I know Portugal was just deadly in their win over Switzerland, but there was something about watching Brazil where I was like, oh, they're having fun. It was like a cat toying with a mostly paralyzed animal. It was like, this is different. Like, it's kind of how I felt about Germany in 2014 when they were so organized. It was like, no one is breaking down this team. Like, that's how I felt watching Brazil. It was like, they are toying with their opposition right now. And I don't say that from a point of disrespect, but it was like, there was such a difference in quality. Like, it was very, it was three-dimensional when you were watching it. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, like they, I don't know which goal it was, maybe the fourth goal where I think Richarlison like chips the ball onto an on-rushing midfielder when he could have just like passed it to someone else standing right next to him, and it leads to a goal. So like, that's what's like, that's prime Brazil, right? Combining the like amazing flair, bordering on disrespect, but it actually like leads to scoring more goals. Yeah. But yeah, the other thing about them is like, their defense is incredible. And then they have probably the best keeper in the world in case you do get past their defense.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some questions about their fullbacks maybe, but like, you know, you have this insane attacking firepower and then it's like impossible to score against them, which, you know, simplify the game. That's pretty much, that's it.
We have been talking with Ryan O'Hanlon from ESPN and the author of Net Gains Inside the Beautiful Games Analytics Revolution. And always the most important question, Ryan, is where can people get your book?
Wherever you buy your books. I think I said it last time. If you buy them online, it's available at every online bookseller. Your local bookstore may or may not have that, may or may not have it. So give them a call and I'm sure they could order it for you if you want to pick it up there if they don't have it. So whatever is the easiest way for you to purchase my book, follow that path.
Nice. Ryan, I'll be bugging you again soon, I promise. I appreciate your time as always, and you have a good one, all right?
Yep, thanks, Ted.
Again, that was Ryan O'Hanlon joining us here on the Soccer Hour, brought to you by your NorCal Honda dealers. We are now joined on the Soccer Hour, brought to you by your NorCal Honda dealers. It is Amanda Vandervoort, the president of the USL Women's Super League. Amanda, what's going on? How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm good. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. And obviously, a lot of stuff going on. The announcement of the NorCal division for the USLW League. We've got this, you know, all these teams coming from Northern California, Glens, as well as the Soul in particular. But we've got areas all over. Just from your perspective, in terms of the, you know, the pathway that this is allowing more athletes now, like, how big is this?
Well, I mean, it's huge. It's huge for us at the USL, for the W League and our entire women's and girls pathway. But I think, you know, it's huge for the country. We had the W League last year. We launched our inaugural season of the W League in 2022. We had 44 teams, but they were all East Coast based.
Yeah.
Which was great. I mean, it was an absolutely tremendous season, you know, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit. But with this expansion now into Northern California, and we have Pacific Northwest as well joining in 2023, we're truly national. And I think that gives, you know, girls and women an opportunity all across this country to really identify, you know, with a team, with the path, you know, to performing at elite levels, you know, in women's soccer.
I was talking to somebody about this the other day about what the USLW is doing, and it may have been a misplaced concern. And I think this is why I would ask you about it is, somebody said they had concerns about it undermining all the good things that the United States NCAA soccer program have done for women's soccer in general and allowing, you know, so many scholarships and opportunities for so many athletes. But I was trying to explain to them, I was like, no, it doesn't undermine it. It works in conjunction. But my answer on that is nowhere near as good as yours could be. So like, how, if somebody presented that opinion to you, what would your response be?
Well, I love that you're singing the praises and appreciate your response, because you're absolutely right. The W League is it runs from May to July and complements the collegiate season, right? So it gives an opportunity for players who don't have that elite playing opportunity in those summer months, the opportunity to play year round. So actually what we're doing is creating developmental opportunities for those players to go on beyond college, if they so choose, or get involved in soccer in other ways once they're done playing in college. So no, we're huge supporters of the college game. And you know, I was a college athlete and a college coach. And I think college soccer has been incredible to the foundation of women's sport, much less women's soccer, you know, in this country. So we're proud to complement, be a part of that. We work really closely with the college coaches and kind of the entire ecosystem of women's soccer.
Yeah. In terms of, you were talking about, you know, this was not previously in the NorCal area, and you're also expanding to the Pacific Northwest. Like, that's something that I always have trouble wrapping my head around, because in Northern California, it's such a diverse area. Women's soccer in general is so big here. We can talk about, you know, the fact that there isn't an NWSL program up here. And I thought maybe there would have been with Sacramento and when MLS was trying to come there, but that was an entire different debacle that you and I can spend hours discussing. But I mean, that's the thing, is like, I feel like there is such a market here for this. Like, people want to go and, cause you know, you go to the fans who show up for Santa Clara and Stanford and Cal and San Jose State here in the Bay Area. Like, there is a very obvious market. People want to go watch these women play.
Yeah, it's huge. And it's longstanding. I mean, women's soccer in this area, girls soccer, the depth of talent here in Northern California is unbelievable. It rivals any place else in the country. And we see that in the number of players that, you know, from this region have featured on the national team, I think, and at all levels, youth national teams, senior national teams. And so, yeah, we want to support that journey for those players. And I'll add that I think that this adds another layer of development for coaches, right? More opportunities for women as coaches, mm-hmm. coaches in the women's game, more games for referees so that we can, you know, help develop the referee pool for the future, for executives in the game. And it gives more platforms for sponsors and investors to get involved in women's sport and demonstrate their commitment to gender equity.
I'm curious, just before I forget to ask you, you touched about the success that you had previously with the USL and trying to get things going last year, but more in the East Coast. What did you learn from that perspective, and how are you applying that to what you're now going to be doing, or what we're going to see happen here in the Northern California area?
Yeah, I love that question. We do a lot. We take a lot of stock in listening to our players and listening to our coaches and the community on what they liked, what they didn't like, what we can do better. And we're implementing, you know, those things in the year to come. So listen, we know what we learned is that fans are hungry for women's soccer. Mm-hmm. First of all, I mean, I would start there. Our final in Minnesota, it was Minnesota Aurora versus Tormenta FC, which is one of our USL League One teams. They launched a W League team, the Tormenta. They ended up winning 2-1. We had 6,500 people at that game. It was rocking. It was rocking. It was a sold out stadium in TCO Stadium in Minneapolis. So, you know, the fans are hungry for it. We also did a survey with our players and coaches after the season, and asked them, you know, would you return to the W League in the future? And would you recommend the W League to a friend? That was one of the things that we thought was really important to understand. And 97% of our coaches and players were like, absolutely, yes, yes, yes. And to us, that's, you know, an indication that we're doing things right. You know, as we move into, you know, new territories, we expand the league, we're very conscious of creating environments where players can compete at the elite level. So we're very conscious about things like scheduling, travel, distance of travel, the commitment that these players are making to engage in elite soccer, you know, in their summertime, and making sure that we're providing the best environment for them to do so.
Yeah. And I also just look at the way that the United States soccer, you know, as a whole, for men and for women, for boys and for girls, like the infrastructure that is existing now, like the opportunities for young athletes to develop their game. Like, to me, that's so huge. I'm sure you hate it as much as I do, as when people make those arguments like, oh, well, if the United States' best athletes played soccer, we'd win the World Cup. And I'm like, hold up. Like, the best athletes play the sports they're drawn to. Like, what? Like, my argument's always been like, we just haven't had the infrastructure, you know, to develop talent the same way that other countries have had it more as part of their sporting culture. Like, you know, England was a ways ahead of what the United States was in terms of development. That said, women's soccer in the United States has always been ahead of the curve. And now we're watching the rest of the world try and catch up, which makes this, to me, even that much more important to give women the ability to do that much more development with their games as they try to transition on that pathway. Because, you know, as good as the U.S. women are, the rest of the world is chomping at the bit.
They are indeed. They are indeed. I spent some time before I was in this job. I was living in Amsterdam as the head of the Global Players Union for Women, Chief Women's Football Officer at FIFPro. And I certainly saw it with my own eyes. There's incredible investment going into the game, especially in Europe, but around the world. And as a result, those teams are becoming much more proficient, you know, in their soccer. And I think we're going to see that at the Women's World Cup this coming summer, 2023, in Australia and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So, we're excited about the infrastructure. You know, I think that's an important thing even to acknowledge on our men's side. You know, 11 of those players in the World Cup right now, in the Men's World Cup in Qatar, 11 of those players have come through the USL system in one way or another. And I think that's a testament to the infrastructure that's been developed here over the years. I mean, before I got here, right? And these players have really been able to come through the system and compete at the highest level, regardless, in a lot of cases, regardless of age. They get into the system, into the pathway, and we at the USL are trying to promote them into the most elite environment so that they can, you know, either become professional or, you know, help push forward our national team. So that's what we're doing on the women's side. We've got on the youth side, we're building out our youth academy. You'll see that this year as well. We'll have girls now competing in our academy program, which is a part of what's been so successful on the men's and boys side. The W League, of course, and in the future with our professional level with the Super League. And so we're creating that new pathway, that new infrastructure that really hasn't existed in this way before. And a lot of it has to do with what's been built on the men's side at the USL. And we're really proud of that.
I know that the plan is for the Glens and the Soul to jump up to that second division, you know, eventually. In terms of how that pertains to what's currently going on in the Bay Area with, you know, competing factions trying to get an NWSL franchise started, like, does this all play a role together? Like, it's very, to me, like, there's a lot of moving parts, and I know that they all have like one hand involved with the other.
I mean, what a moment in time this is. Let's be honest. Like the fact that we're having this conversation about the amount of investment and interest there is in women's soccer, and and we're just talking about the microcosm of Northern California and the Bay Area in particular, right? And yeah, it's moving, it's dynamic, and it's going to be amazing to see the professional soccer market in this region come to life. There's absolutely no hesitation and no doubt in the player pool, the fan, you know, the fan interest, and I think the sponsor and partner and investment opportunity is so incredibly strong. So, you know, and that's this area. But now you take that and you multiply it across this country, and it's just like women's soccer it's a movement. It's a massive like flood right now of interest, and it's just so cool.
Well, the most one of the most amazing things that I've ever seen was when the women's national team was at PayPal Park to play a game, and I'm trying to remember, it was like November of maybe 2016. And Kristen Press had a big game, and of course she's got the Stanford background, so she's got built-in fans. But I remember watching the, you know, where they walk out from the locker rooms to the pitch, there's a little tunnel there, and there were just, you know, huge amounts of fans on either side with people on their shoulders. And I was like, it wasn't even like this when Manchester United was here. I was like, this is what I would expect to see for like Elvis or something. Like, this was such rock star status that it blew my mind. Cause just to give you a little background on me, like I'm 40 now. I'm a product of the 90s. Big sporting moment in my life was between 1996 and 1999 when Nike invested so much in that women's national team. We talk about Julie Foudy, Mia Hamm, Brandi Chastain, and the list goes on and on. But with that 1999 World Cup, that led to the WUSA. And my dad was actually the broadcaster for the Cyber Rays here with that league. So I used to go to the games at Spartan Stadium. Right. but what amazed me is because 1999, Brandi Chastain, most famous, you know, one of the, I would say, three most famous sports photos of all time, with her, you know, ripping off her shirt and the guns flexed and the sports bra on the abs. Like, it was just like, okay, like, here we go. And then those games at Spartan Stadium, like, there, it wasn't like what I expected to be. The games were great, but the crowd wasn't there. And I was like, what's the disconnect? So like, to watch it take this time, like, it's been there, but it feels like now the powers that be, such as yourself, have much more of the ability and the know-how to make this and sell it. Whereas before, I feel like, and I'm not trying to denigrate anyone or talk down, but it's like, it was almost like they had so much on their hands, they didn't quite know what to do with it. Whereas now it seems like people have a much better idea of how to manage it.
I think it's that. I think certainly there have been people now working in the game who have experience, whether it's like myself. I was at Major League Soccer for 10 years and I used that, you know, I leveraged that experience and knowledge that I gained when I was there and now apply it into the women's game. And I think we're starting to see a lot more people, maybe with that experience. And hopefully we can add to that by creating more teams and more platforms, you know, for them to grow and learn. So I think it's that, you know, the professionalization of the game broadly, which of course includes executives and staff and people working in the game. But I also think it's fan behaviors and fan viewing habits, how they're evolving in like a digital ecosystem, and how we see fans of women's soccer are incredibly engaged. So, you know, and they might not historically have been as vast and broad, but they're really, really engaged, and they always bring a friend along with them. So we're seeing influencer culture within a sporting environment really impact the growth of the game. And I think there's, you know, I mean, the fact that we're here talking about it is an indication that, you know, I mean, maybe I remember a stat about 10 years ago, I would say, no, 5 years ago, actually, that 4% of all sports coverage in the United States is about women's sports. And the last stat I heard about 2 months ago, that study had been redone, and now it's 10%. So we're actually starting to see that media is having a huge impact on telling these stories, because women athletes are awesome. These games are amazing. The atmosphere, the environment is second to none. And sometimes, you know, it's about telling the stories and just making people aware of what's happening. Because, you know, once you go, you're hooked.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. I mean, I look at what happened in San Diego this year with Wave FC and the way that people jumped onto that. I mean, that was, you know, people didn't know what was going to happen. And I lived in San Diego for a couple of years. And, you know, I wouldn't say it's the greatest sports market in the world, but it's just like they threaded the needle there. And it's interesting to note, like, when I have Izzy DeQuilla from Santa Clara on, or, you know, a Kelsey Turnbow, I get tons of reaction to those interviews, more so than I would from other athletes that I have on, which is like, that shows you like that fan engagement is so huge and people are just all in on it. So if they see it, and, you know, we look at what Just Women's Sports has been doing, and I'm friends with Haley Kottmeyer, former goalkeeper from the NWSL. She knows what's up. She knows the stories. Like, it's taken a long time, but I mean, I would even say that 10% is probably not quite an accurate representation. I would imagine it would be even more, because I mean, you look at the numbers that, you know, women's soccer gets when the national team is on. You look at just the engagement. I've been making the argument for years, and I would, as big as Christian Pulisic's goal was the other day, I still think more people recognize Alex Morgan. Like, I still feel like more people, they saw them in the crowd, like, wait, I know her. You know, like, they would know, you know, one star versus the other, which is, again, I'm not trying to compete them against each other, and we can get into a, you know, greater conversation at some other point about the revenue. But, I mean, like, the market is there. And I, you know, to jump back on that, like, if people are listening to this, they're hearing us talking about, okay, USLW coming now after it's been in the East Coast, South, Midwest, it's at NorCal now. How do they get more information about it?
Yeah, you can go to our website, uslsoccer.com. Do we have uslwleague.com? Is that where we direct people to? Yeah, okay. Just check in with my friend here in the room. Just check in the right place to direct our listeners to. uslwleague.com. But really, like, you know, the best place I think is go to Twitter and follow us there, uslwleague, and on Instagram, because, you know, we run this, you know, we're a pre-professional league, but we run it as though it's an amateur, it's a professional property. Yeah. So you can get all the news and information through all of our, you know, social media and on our website, you know, and also, like, my DMs, like, send me a message if you want more information. We can send you, you know, to get it where you want. I'm Vandia1 on Twitter, and I love to engage with fans. I love hearing, you know, what people think. And I would say the same of all of our clubs. Like, that's one of the things about women's soccer. We're accessible. We want to be part of the community with the fans and with the players. And I feel like I've lived and breathed that as a player and a coach and a fan myself. And so that's part of it too.
And just, you know, as a question for you, as the president of the USL Super League, like, how do you judge yourself? Like, how, cause you're like, it's not like there's other ways we can judge other positions, but like when you're a president, like, your responsibilities are so wide ranging. Like, how are you judging yourself in terms of how you're doing your job? And I don't even know if there is like an accurate answer for that, or if you've just been like, my God, Ted, how do you want to go for 2 hours here?
I know. Well, I think there's two questions kind of that I'm maybe hearing. One is, you know, how do we judge success of the organization, of the Super League, of the W League, you know, our academy, Super Y, like, you know, and I think those are going to come down to the long-term sustainability of the organization, ensuring that we are supporting our clubs to build successful businesses, both on and off the field, and giving players the pathways to, you know, to be professional or compete on our national team, and ensuring that the players are satisfied and happy and feel that they have the elite environments to be able to do that. So, like, I think on one hand, that's the business for me. I'm very values driven. Like, I believe, you know, I'm very reflective to make sure that I'm doing what I believe in personally, and that the mission of what we're building on the business side is aligned with my own, you know, personal values and mission. And I think, I'm fortunate in life to be able to ask myself those questions about my work day in and day out. But that's kind of, if I'm successful, it means I'm, you know, I'm affecting people's lives in a positive way through soccer.
Awesome. Well, Amanda, I know you've got a busy day and other things to do, but I really appreciate your time. I know everybody's excited for the NorCal division of the USLW League. And again, I think this is going to be great. And I will direct people to your DMs and to the website and other things. But thank you so much for your time. And I hope I can bug you again for another interview soon. All right.
Always. This is awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
Again, that was Amanda Vandervoort joining us here on the Soccer Hour on KMBR 1050, brought to you by your NorCal Honda dealers. Thank you for joining us on the extended podcast version for the San Jose Earthquakes and your NorCal Honda dealers. I'm Ted Ramey signing off.
This has been the Soccer Hour with Ted Ramey, presented by the San Jose Earthquakes and your local NorCal Honda dealers on KMBR 1050, the sports leader.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draftaccess to register for free entry today.